Did you ever think you would make it? I feel I'm so close, I could taste sweet victory. I know this life meant for me. Yeah. Why would you bet on Goliath when we got Bet David? Value taming, giving values contagious. This world of entrepreneurs, we gain no value to haters. How they run, homie, look what I become. I'm the one.
Strike. And so I went on a pudding strike.
Oh, nice. So folks, I don't know if you heard that or not. There's a major amazing, pudding strike going on that we're going to talk about. But today's guests, they're kind of a big deal, both of them. You know, I had a chance to communicate. Buck and I were going back and forth, and then we had a chance to be on the show. And then, you know, you've been around the block for a while. Your name is everywhere. Everyone knows the Buck Sexton, you know, Clay Travis and the Buck Sexton Show. Whether it's sports, whether it's politics, whether it's boobs, whether it's LeBron. There's a lot of different things going on out there.
I'm an expert.
You're an expert.
Yeah, I like to think.
And Buck, you being a CIA agent. This, by the way, we just broke a record. First time in a week we've had two former CIA officers. We had a Mike Baker on.
My man, I saw Mike. I did Gutfeld show with him last week.
Did you?
Mike and I go way back. Yes.
Mike stud, full on.
Mike is a interesting, fun guy when he comes here. But today's about you guys. Appreciate you guys for coming out
and being on the show.
So, Clay, you know, for some of the folks, obviously we got stories to get into. You saw what Musk did with BBC, destroyed him, and where he started interviewing the other guy. We got stats that came out from New York City, a poll talking about 27% of people living in New York want to leave New York. I want to get your feedback because you lived in New York before. We got some other things going on with this guy named, I don't know if you guys are following this one guy named Joe Biden. he's always saying stuff that we have to cover. France is kind of talking about the fact that Europe's got to stop relying so much on America. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Maybe we're financing everything they're doing. We can talk about that as well. California's on the edge after tech layoffs and studio cutbacks. NPR quits Twitter. Lots of people were heartbroken last night when that announcement was made. Popovich wants gun control. Cruz hits back. NBA blames economy. By the way, when I first read this article, what did I ask you, Rob? I said, what NBA is this? And you said, it is the National Basketball Association. So I didn't believe it. NBA blames economy for hiring freeze and budget cuts. Giannis kind of opened up recently about what's going on with him, what went on with him. Aaron Rodgers appears to have endorsed RFK. Interesting to see that taking place. And then we got Riley Gaines rips Nike for the partnership with Dylan Mulvaney. And then claps back at accusations. She spread violence at SFSU event. And Joe Rogan had some Bud Light yesterday on the podcast. I don't know if you guys caught
it. Oh, I didn't even see that.
He had some Bud Light yesterday on. He says, listen, product's a great product. I want to have it. It was so interesting the way he did it. But that's Joe. You got to love Joe for that. So prior to getting into it, I know your story. I've known your story for years. But for the audience, if you don't mind taking a moment and sharing your background, that would be great. We can start off with you first.
So I'm Buck, and I was born and raised in New York City. I'm now a Floridian, though, a Miamian, part of the refugee wave from New York City to Florida as a result of COVID. But taking it back a little bit, for anyone in your audience who knows New York City, I went to Regis, which if you're from New York, you might know. It's the only free private school in the country that I went to, so everyone's on a full scholarship. Then I went to Amherst College, came right out of Amherst, went right into the CIA because 9/11, New Yorker, American. Did CIA from 2005 to 2010, deployed to Iraq twice, deployed to Afghanistan, went to some places in sub-Saharan Africa that I still don't really talk about, and learned some interesting stuff from that. Did a year at the NYPD Intelligence Division, and then Glenn Beck found me out of nowhere. I was the CIA guy who had been in Iraq, Afghanistan, was working effectively as a consultant for the NYPD Intelligence Division, because it's my hometown. And Glenn's person emailed me out of the blue and was like, I heard about you. We should have a meeting. I swear to God. And it was actually almost weirder than the original CIA recruitment stuff where I was showing up like abandoned office buildings. There's like no one there, but there is somebody there, you know?
All the way in the back.
You know, yeah, there's like one guy sitting on a folding chair that you talk to. So Glenn brought me in the business at the Blaze 12 years ago now. And and then from there I started doing radio, started filling in for Glenn and then Sean Hannity, then Rush Limbaugh, and did some other things along the way, CNN, Fox, all that good stuff. And then they paired me up with Clay to take over as the official Premier Radio Network's replacement. Pardon me, filling the slot left vacant by the greatest of all time, Rush Limbaugh.
What a pair. I mean, to follow that guy. I mean, they're not going to just put somebody in that position that doesn't know what they're doing. I remember when that announcement was made, and everybody said, damn, that's a pretty big deal. So, you know, obviously people that follow the space know how big of a deal that is. Clay, how about yourself?
Yeah, to speak on what Buck said, I mean, I came out of the world of sports, and you usually don't want to be the guy who follows Bill Belichick or Nick Saban, because usually the standard is so high, and
that's
think that's why Julie Talbot, who's our boss at Premier, put the two of us in as opposed to one person. So I think it automatically shifted the dynamic as opposed to this guy is trying to fill the shoes, as we've said and Buck said, I think, pretty well. You know, we can each fill one shoe, and it's a different show. And I think that was super smart by her. But I look, I was an attorney. I grew up in Nashville, went to George Washington in D.C., went to Vanderbilt Law School, graduated, moved to the Caribbean. I practiced law down there for a couple of years at the biggest law firm in the Caribbean. 13 attorneys, by the way, in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And while I was there, I had what I would call a quarter-life crisis, where you look around, and I know there's probably a lot of lawyers out there. Some people say, oh, you get your law degree, it's amazing. But every lawyer I've ever known that I really like has always got a plan to get out of having to practice law.
Really?
Yeah, at least in my experience.
Why is that? Why are so many lawyers doing that?
I think because when you're in law school and when you're working up towards that, what I always say is law school, you get to debate big, important issues. You get to study the most seminal cases that have ever existed in the legal process. And then your first year, you're 25 or 26 years old, and you sit in front of a computer and you do doc review. And so it is not this few good men, a time to kill caliber experience. And I think a lot of young lawyers sort of have that gilded, this is going to be amazing. And you make a decent living, but it's an awful job, especially as a young lawyer, in my experience. And I always say, and this is my advice to anybody out there who's young and think about it, if you don't want your boss's job, you should find something new to do. Don't just look directly above you. Look at the person who's your boss's boss. If you see what they do and you're like, this doesn't really have that much appeal to me, there's nothing wrong with doing a job you don't love. Everybody has to do it. But if you aspire to truly love what you do, then if you don't want to do what your boss's boss does, that's the next 10, 15 years of
your life.
So you
don't want to own a law firm. You don't want to run a law firm.
I didn't want to run
a
law firm. And so I practiced law for a few years, started writing online. I worked, and I was in the world of sports. So probably the reason why I ended up writing online is speaking to being a young lawyer, and everybody I knew graduated with was a young lawyer. You're hoping to find 10 or 15 minutes of entertainment on the internet during your day. You're not happy. You want to go click and go read this article or whatever. So I started writing hopefully funny, amusing, humorous articles online about Southeastern Conference football. I was a monster, still am, college football fan in general. And that led to, I did that for years. Eventually, I was making $100 a week at CBS Sportsline, if you remember that website back in the day.
CBS Sportsline?
Yeah.
Did you? What year was that when you were there?
I started writing there in 05.
Did you work with Peter Madden?
I know that name, yes.
Yeah, like, very interesting. Yeah.
But so they were based here.
Down the street.
Yeah, down the street. Yeah. They paid me $100 a week to write
Killing
two columns. $100 a week. So after years, I'd made $5,000 at that point a year, and I was still practicing law full time. That eventually led to they got me up to, I think, to 35 or 40K, and I thought I was like, this is amazing. Then I went to Deadspin, if you guys remember Deadspin back in its heyday. This is kind of early web, you know, I would say almost 1.0. I had good timing, you know, the blogosphere was just kind of taking off. And then I was at Fan House. I got fired. They shut down the entire, if you guys remember the Fan House business model, they shut down everything. Everybody got fired, whole place. And I started a website called The Outkick in 2011. And I sold that to Fox 2 years ago. And so slowly I moved from, hey, let's rank the top five quarterbacks. I did national sports talk radio. I did local sports talk radio. And then when COVID happened, March, April, May, June, our audience skyrocketed. And it was not sports. And so our boss, Julie Talbot, when Rush passed, came and said, hey, the data reflects people just want to hear your opinion, not just about sports.
How was that? How was that to to hear that people want to hear your opinion on politics, not just sports. Was that a easy transition for you?
Well, it was. I loved the show that I did.
Yeah.
And it was early morning Fox Sports Radio. I was on 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. And I think this is where having the kids, you start a pivot and think not only about yourself, but about the larger world. And I love talking about who's going to win the Super Bowl or who's going to win the NBA play. But it doesn't matter, right? It's all 100% entertainment. And so whether schools are open during COVID or, frankly, whether kids can go play high school sports, because you guys probably know, and I know Buck does too, I got lots of people I know who wouldn't have had success in life if they hadn't gotten to play on the right high school team or have the right coach, especially boys. And so I was just so fired up about finding ways to play. And sports had become more and more, unfortunately, intertwined with politics, I would say, really kind of taken off with the Colin Kaepernick protest and that whole world. That it was like, in many ways, you were talking about politics when you tried to talk about sports. And so, yeah, I remember Julie saying, and this is true, we're very fortunate. We have basically the biggest radio show in the country. She said, look, you could have the best and biggest sports talk show that exists in the country, and I think you're on track to be able to do that. It would still be a pinprick of the influence that the audience that you're going to be able to talk to in Rush's time slot would be able to influence.
The first time I filled in for Rush was, I think, so I was a guest host for him for years, just to Clay's point. I think it was 2014 or 2015, so it was a ways back. I made this sort of proclamation. I'm like, I'm going to respond. Anyone who wants to email me, you know, I'm going to respond, you know, because I was used to doing, I started doing digital radio before I was on terrestrial radio on the weekends.
Yeah.
I had a stream on the Blaze. I was super early in the sort of podcast stream space, relatively speaking, and then transitioned to terrestrial, which is kind of not the way people usually do it. But I was used to, I tell Clay this, because I was a writer for TheBlaze.com, and I was doing Blaze TV and Blaze Radio. So I was doing all three of these at the time. This is when I got my start. And I could actually see, did you have a chart beat or one of those things?
Oh, where you could see, yeah.
I could see doing my show, like, there'd be nine people listening. This is when I first started. And then I'd talk about something and like a couple would drop off. And I'm like, oh man, I just lost 30% of my audience or like 20% of my audience or whatever. So it would like kind of freak me out a little bit. But you know, I always found that it was interesting to see that radio seemed to bring in the people who just had the most content all the time. Like that was my impression coming in, like people who had the most to share. Because, you know, TV, you have people who are amazing and people who, you know, are relying on the
likes. What stops you more? Which audience stops you more? You know how, you know, the other day I'm at a church and this guy comes up and he says, you're the TikTok guy. I'm like, dude, I'm not a TikTok guy.
That's awesome, by the way.
I'm not a TikTok guy.
I would say this.
That's awesome.
Whenever
one guy at UFC is like, you're the jeweler. That's right. You're a jewelry guy. You're like,
one watch video.
Just what the thing I forgot to say was, Clay, I said I would respond. I spent like 6 hours responding to emails from doing Rush's show once. I've never seen anything like it before in my life in terms of the platform and the connection.
What was the number? 20 to 30 million, I would hear, right? What was
that
number?
Was the reach on a monthly basis.
That's
20 to 30 million
to
listeners.
Doing.
Yeah. And what we've seen too since then, and yeah, the reach is still amazing. I think we have 500 affiliate stations nationwide, roughly. But also now we've layered on top of that the podcast, which is, and Buck and I are, Buck likes to make fun of it. He's 3 years younger than me, which totally.
Old man, look at all the gray in that beard.
I'm the last year of Gen X, and he's one of the first years of the millennials. So that's why I'm so much more likable. But, you know, then you layer on top of it tens of millions of downloads. And what we found, I'm sure you have seen it too. It's funny you say, oh, you're the TikTok guy. There was this initial fear in radio that you would cannibalize your audience. And what the data actually reflects is people come now from so many different directions. So you're asking a really interesting question. What do people recognize? Because I did 4 years of sports gambling daily on FS1. So, like, when I came in, when I'm flying to Fort Lauderdale yesterday, or thought I was before the flood,
22 inches of rain, by the way, but
crazy.
Go ahead.
It's unbelievable. I go through, and the guy checking my ID is like, man, who you got tonight in the NBA playoffs, right? And then so I, you know, give him picks, and I went 1-1, so whatever. But I felt bad. He was like, if you go 0-2, I'm going to blow you up on Twitter. I was like, I know, buddy. Trust me. And then get to the airplane. And people are like, man, can you believe what Macron said about, you know, I'm sitting waiting to get on the flight. And somebody wants to talk about Macron. So it's kind of people come from different directions with their own perspectives. And that was always kind of my goal. I wanted them to want to talk about Game of Thrones or, you know, what's going on in politics or, you know, whatever would be on the front page of the newspaper, top of mind.
So you asked a really interesting question because it's something that I learned from years of seeing it play out, not just with me, but with other hosts who are friends. The people who know you from TV tend to recognize you. The people who know you from radio know you. They will hug you. They will come up to you and they'll talk about, you know, your dog, or they'll come up and they just, because they spend so much time. Now, granted, I haven't hosted a show on Fox, so it's
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Different from people just from, but I mean, if they see you on TV doing appearances, they're like, oh, I like your content. If they're spending 2, maybe 3 hours a day with you, 5 days a week. I mean, we always joke, I spend more time talking to Clay than anybody in his family with the possible exception of his wife, right? Imagine the audience.
I definitely talk more to you than 15 hours. I mean, have you talked 15 hours to your wife? I mean,
no, it's kind of,
now that I think about this. So the people who recognize you from TV, do you spend a lot of time at senior homes? Is that kind of what you do?
Is that
what's going on?
I mean, that's a good shot, but I'll tell you this. I mentioned I had three boys. I took a picture of your 1 million YouTube thing in the lobby.
Yeah.
Because all my boys watch is YouTube.
Yeah.
They watch sports, live sports with me, and then everything else they do YouTube. So when I show them that 1 million, I got to meet Mr. Beast a couple years ago.
He's like 100.
Small YouTube channel, no big deal.
But my kids, I mean, I would imagine it was like getting to meet Elvis in 1960, you know, to them.
I think it was kind of joking with you about, hey, is your audience at a senior community? But the landscape has changed, right? TV, cable news, older audience, radio. My first job out of college was in radio. This is 2002, 2003, Clear Channel.
Yep.
It was the king of the hill right there. Rob worked in radio for, I don't know, forever. I think he even had a radio show at one point, did you
know? KRLA, Hugh Hewitt and those guys, like 15, 13 years ago.
Forever ago. Yeah. But now the landscape is YouTube, podcasts, and things have changed, right?
I mean,
what have you seen the biggest difference been?
So the demos are obviously different from podcast, YouTube. I mean, you know, I would say TikTok, which is kind of replace Snapchat in the, you know, in this hierarchy or in this separation.
Which
that would be the youngest.
Vine,
right. That's like the youngest demo for content. And then right above that, probably you have YouTube. And then above that, you have podcasting. And then above that, you have cable news in terms of, you know, age stratification. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the very top of it, I would say terrestrial radio tends to be an older, more established.
Newspapers, you know, above that. I still get the journal.
So the only two people I know on the planet who get the old school paper, Wall Street Journal, are my dad and Clay.
I know I like you, buddy. Old school.
He's got the ninja moves with the actual physical paper. But no, we approach it. I mean, one thing that I was told, because so, you know, Glenn started the Blaze when he left Fox, and he'd had that. Remember that when he used to do
the four E's and the Fox? He used to crush it, by the way. That show was people wouldn't miss it at night.
So I was at the intelligence division, the NYPD, and I just remember we had all these screens up that, you know, some of it is like trying to stop terrorism, but also then there were TVs. then there were TVs of, you know, the news, and it would all turn to Glenn at five o'clock, you know, every day. And but one thing that he recognized very early on, I actually don't think he gets enough credit for this in the conservative space, is he was like, we just need to be present with good content everywhere. So he was into podcasting, streaming. I remember Roku. I didn't even know what a Roku was. I went to work at the Blaze, and they had Roku for TV. So, you know, in the early days of that, you could see that there were going to be a lot more ways for people to consume content. But the good news is that it also means the audience is a lot bigger. But then again, everybody has a podcast. Like, people come up to me now. They're like, hey, I want to start a podcast. I'm like, have you ever done a podcast? You know, like, I'm like, I mean, that's great. Like, go for it. But, you know, it feels like these days a lot of people are everyone wants to be an influencer. That's the term, an influencer.
Well, I'll build on, you mentioned that somebody came up and said you're a TikTok guy. So you guys, I don't know if you've seen this clip. If you haven't, you should watch it. Like 4 years ago, I went on CNN and said I only believed in two things completely, the First Amendment and boobs, right? Live on the air. They banned me. I'm not allowed on CNN now.
Because you said boobs.
Because I said boobs.
Straight up.
It was my friend who banned him, by the way, but I didn't know him at the time, so otherwise I would have stepped in.
Just because you said the word, the context was
all over the place. This was all over the news.
It was the number one trending topic in America. She wanted me to apologize. I didn't do it. The reason why I bring it up is that was like 4 or 5 years ago. My oldest son, last year.
They've got it on the screen.
Yeah, there we go. That's it.
Oh, man.
I'm a First Amendment absolutist. I believe in only two things completely, the First Amendment and boobs. And so once they made the decision that they were not going to allow a conservative non-sports-related commentary, they couldn't do it either.
Hold on. I just want to make sure I heard you correctly as a woman anchoring the show. Did you say, what did you just say? You believe in the First Amendment and BOOBS?
You can't even say
boobs.
It.
Two things that have only never let me down in this entire country's history, the First Amendment and boobs. First Amendment absolutist, I believe.
So you got canceled because of that.
Oh, they tried. I mean, legitimately, they tried to get me fired off my radio show. I mean, I owned OutKick. So, I mean, that's one of the benefits, I think, of owning your own methods of distribution. And I would say to anybody who wants to get involved in media, one of the most important things is you have to control, I believe, your ability to make money in some way. Because there is so much pressure out there on media entities that as soon as you get a little bit outside of the acceptable bounds of discourse, but that clip that you guys watched, I think that was 2017-ish, 18, whatever it was, it suddenly went viral on TikTok. And so every kid in my kid's school...
Very interesting.
...never knew it existed.
Got it.
Right? Because they're like 8 or 9 years old when that happens.
Yeah.
Suddenly, every one of them had seen it. Millions of people. It was all positive. The kids loved it, but that was an audience that had never seen me.
I first saw your content on TikTok, by the way.
So
there are a number of people.
So,
I mean, I know from the podcast, obviously, but that's also how... I mean, I know you guys had Tate on, and you know he's now home confinement right in Romania. I've been reaching out. We've been reaching out to his team for a couple of weeks right before the arrest happened because we wanted to have him on. It's funny because I was like, look, this guy says really interesting stuff. I know he's controversial and all that stuff, and obviously he's facing these charges now. But Clay and I talked about it. We hadn't, you know, brought it up before. I looked at him. I'm like, I see this guy on TikTok. I think we should have him on the show. I think it's really interesting, some of the stuff that he's saying. And he's like, he's my son's favorite influencer.
My two oldest boys. I'll go and I'll say like, hey, because I mentioned they're on YouTube.
How old are your boys, by the way?
15, 12, and 8.
Okay.
So the two
teenagers,
oldest.
Not below teenagers.
Oh, yeah. The two oldest. I said, hey, if I could have anybody on the radio show, who would you like me to have on? And they both instantaneously said Andrew Tate. And then Buck brought him up like the next, you know, 2 or 3 days
just
later.
Happenstance, yeah.
But I think it speaks to there's a lot of boys out there, and we've talked about this on our show, that feel lost in this sort of toxic masculinity era. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for, that's why I mentioned coaches earlier, but that masculine influence who can teach them how to be men. And I feel like his individual, like, hey, just go do more push-ups and stop being a pussy. Like, that actually connects a lot, you guys remember, with 13, 14, 15-year-old boys.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I asked the question when I said, like, who's the audience? When people come in, they'll talk to me. I'll say, so how do you know about us and what we do? Oh, I watch Vitamin all the time. I said, do you watch the podcast or just Vitamin? Which podcast? Oh, okay, great. So you're more the Vitamin audience. How about yourself? You know, I watch the podcast and I listen, you know, through Spotify. Okay, so Spotify, interesting audience. What do you do for? I want to know what the background of these guys are.
Yeah.
TikTok, if I go to school with my kids, their kids will, their friends will stop by because they're TikTok audience, right? Yeah. Snap audience, I can't really find a Snapchat audience. There's Instagram, there's YouTube, there's Spotify, there's, you know, TikTok, but it's different. If I go on Fox and I see who stops me, I'm on a Dan Bongino show, and next thing you know, the following day, hey, you know, I saw you sitting on the Dan Bongino show. So, okay, that makes sense. Older crowd.
Yeah.
It's a very different crowd. But the thing when you're starting out, I think, is you got to, when you're newer, not you guys. You guys are, at this point, you're vets. You're running the show with the biggest eyeballs. You took a spot that everybody won. Everybody was fighting for that spot. I remember the whole talk was, this guy's going to get it. Yeah. Is he going to get it? Is that going to get it? No way. Thank God. That's insane, right? Everybody was talking about that slot. But when you start out, it's important to have a very niche audience to start off with. And then gradually, as you go wider and you talk other opinions, people say, damn, you actually can talk about that stuff? Can we hear more things like that? Kind of like what you were talking about earlier.
The thing about radio, I said, like, the people come up, hug, and I literally mean that. Like, if someone comes up and they're like, Buck, and they hug me and I don't know them, they listen to me on radio, and some of them have been listening for 12 years.
It's crazy.
I mean, there's some people. Yeah. There have been, I know of a couple that's married because they both listened to my show, and through hashtags, they found each other. I swear to God, guys in the military found each other, found
so
this
you're a matchmaker
lovely lady.
As well.
Just because Buck, they love the
show.
What
don't you do? You know, CIA. Yeah, the most impressive thing for some of the people that listen from TikTok is when you said you transitioned. Because that's becoming very common nowadays to transition, and it's impressive that maybe you started that eight years ago.
I like to think that I'm a guy who adapts very quickly. You know, that's part of the training, part of the CIA training, and plus we had, you know, understanding of how to shape.
My name is Buck Sexton, and I've transitioned from
CIA to media.
They're just gonna clip that on TikTok.
That's
and you're
gonna
be trans.
So, real quick, you're talking about all these platforms. It also is. It's a business strategy, but it's also a survival mechanism. And we saw this particularly during COVID. I mean, survival. You know, within the business, because now everyone really understands what some of us have been shouting about for a long time. We've both dealt with this a bit. I mean, you showed Clay trying to get canceled. I've been throttled, suspended, kicked off, account shut down. And it was all really over COVID stuff. So now people understand that you got to be on, you know, on YouTube, on Rumble, on Spotify, all these different places. Because if you go all in on one place, they will turn the lights off on you for political reasons, for nonsense reasons, right? Not for anything that anybody. So that's why I think also being multi-platform is kind of a necessity now for almost everybody who's in the business.
More than being a multi-platform individual yourself is who's running those different platforms. Like, one of the best things that happened is Spotify backed up Rogan, okay, Musk bought Twitter,
yep,
and Rumble is growing. Those three things are very, very good for content creators. Because just 2-3 years ago, one person in Silicon Valley canceled you, 99 other people canceled you as well, similar to what happened to a couple guys that we both know about. All right, let's go into some stories here. You're from New York, okay?
Yes, sir.
Article came out yesterday from New York Post. Nearly a third of New Yorkers want to move out. This is after all the 330,000, you know, the numbers that we've all read about and how many people left. Nearly a third of New Yorkers want to move out, fed up with crime, housing costs, poor schools, and more. If you look at the bottom with stats, New Yorkers are so worried about crime, sky-high housing costs, and struggling schools. 27% of state residents said they want to move away in the next 5 years. A survey revealed a stunning 30% respondents who also cited inept political leadership and soaring taxes as reasons for wanting to flee said they already long to live somewhere else, according to Siena College Research Institute Quality of Life poll. Nearly a third, 31%, plan to leave the Empire State when they retire, while even more said they believe it's not safe for kids. Angela Gutierrez, 38, of East Harlem, is one of the New Yorkers who will soon ditch the state. The more and more you looked at the stats, I mean, this was a place that everybody wanted to be at. Bottom stats I'll read to you, and then I'll turn it over to you guys. 67% of residents in New York wasn't affordable, while only 30% said it was. 49% of respondents said New York fair or poor when asked if it's a place where they feel safe from crime. Only 51% gave an answer of good or excellent. Crime surged during the pandemic. 60% of New York is not a good place to retire, while 38% said it was. 57% said the political system doesn't work. I mean, I can go on and on and on and on and on What do you think is really happening in New York? Because when I talk to New Yorkers, they'll say things like this. They'll say, no one's going to leave New York. No matter what they say, no one's leaving New York. This is the place to be. This is the Mecca. This is where everybody comes to. What's really going on in New York?
People who say that are unfortunately delusional. So I'm born and raised in New York City. Both my parents were born in New York City. Three of my four grandparents were born in New York City. So we go back quite a ways in NYC. I grew up in a New York, just for the purpose of the audience to understand what has happened here, because New York went through an incredible, really almost miraculous fix, and now has been ruined again, effectively, or is in the process, I should say, of being ruined. So when I grew up in New York City, which is early, like let's say early 90s, 1990, New York had over 2,200 murders, okay? People go back, and they say there's no way. You can check that statistic. It was 22-something, over 2,000 murders, which when you think about what we're looking at now in different cities, I mean, New York went from 2,200 murders. Giuliani comes in. There's this whole change in the approach to crime and criminal justice and everything.
Yep.
By the time I'm graduating high school, New York is now looking at, can we get below 300 murders? Think about that. From 2,200 people gunned down to in a decade or so, you're like, can we get it to like 250, 275? So that happened, which was phenomenal. And New York, I do think, obviously 9/11, but actually the response from the city to 9/11, and it was incredible how fast the bounce back was from the biggest attack on our country since Pearl Harbor. And obviously it's what led me to the CIA and I literally got out of college and I was like, I want to help find bin Laden and kill that SOB. Like, that was my mission in life. I went to work for CTC and the CIA. So New York was this amazing place. It got super safe. Clay always says on the show, and it's totally true, that you want to be able to live in a place where your wife can go jogging at night and you don't even think twice about it. And I'm telling you, New York in the 2000s, from let's say 2000 to 2010, 2011, before de Blasio, 100% the case. So then you get de Blasio who comes in. The problem is New York City had been so safe, so wealthy, and was the Mecca that those people talk about, that it seemed like it was, you know, an unsinkable battleship of awesomeness, right? It's just, oh, okay, we can raise taxes, we can start to do things that are, we can go a little more lax on crime, let's get rid of stop and frisk, let's change some of these policies. We've made it safe, we don't need to keep doing these things anymore. And it started to deteriorate. What they don't realize is that there's a momentum to these things. Not only did you have de Blasio at the top pushing effectively socialist policies in New York, but then you also bring in, and I had one of my best friends in the world was in the district attorney's office for like over a decade. So I was always talking to him about this, and I worked at the NYPD. You start seeding, they talk about the Soros-backed prosecutors. Yeah, you also get leftist radicals, not only in these different activist groups, but also they start working for city government themselves. They start coming in. They start pushing this ideology more. And then as the city began to deteriorate, you could see that they were still hoping, well, you have to be here. That's the thing about New York. It was kind of like Hollywood and L.A. and Silicon Valley, right? Mm-hmm. These places mm-hmm. where they got you. There's almost a monopoly on the industry. Well, COVID comes along. So even though there are people like, this is getting, it's getting dirty, it's getting unsafe, it's way too expensive. They got rid of the SALT deduction. COVID comes along, and now you realize you're actually ruled over by totalitarian morons who don't care if they create misery and economic destruction because they think that this is what social justice looks like. New York is going to take at least a decade, if not decades, to recover to what it was based on the damage that was done, particularly, I'd say, in the last 10 years in the city. But COVID just sent it all into overdrive. So that's how it all broke down.
I felt fortunate because I lived in Nashville, just south of town, and it was like COVID didn't even exist. You know, I mean, I came down here, my kids were out of school, you know, March, April, May, and I came down to Florida and we spent May because I was like, how often are the kids going to be out for the whole time? We'll just spend a month at the beach. But I think I went up to visit where Buck lived. And New York is great, not because for most people where they live in New York City, but because when you leave your apartment, you can experience the city. And what COVID did was take away the experience. And a lot of people were like, this is kind of a shitty place to live if you don't have the larger experience of the city. And then on top of what Buck said, I think a lot of people then made choices that they never would have if COVID didn't happen. And they said, okay, I'm going to try to do my job and I'm going to go outside of the city. And what they found out was I can be just as efficient outside of the city as I would be otherwise. Because you would have never... Suddenly, if you got a successful business, you never would have made the choices to try things that you had to do during COVID. But when you did, I think what happened, and I've been on this and for a while, COVID made red redder and blue bluer. And it accelerated what I think has become very much of a national divorce. And I'll be honest with you. If I had been living in New York City or L.A., when I started Outkick, to Buck's point, everybody said, you can't run a media business from Nashville. You're going to have to move at some point to New York or L.A. I think that's totally false. I think there are a lot of different cities now where there's a lot of talent in them. Miami, South Florida is one. Nashville is one where I live. Austin, Texas is one. And people realize that they could be based anywhere. And so the allure of New York City, when your kids are having to wear masks for years, when your kids are having to live remotely, when you're cramped in a tiny little apartment, you can barely get outside to walk a dog, and you can't take your kids to a park, suddenly wasn't there. And I think it's going to take a while, because now people have experienced other things. Buck, you know this. Like, suddenly
I'm
like,
one of these people.
Yeah,
I
you're like,
Florida.
Wait a minute. I can a million-dollar place in New York, I get, you know, 700 square feet on the 28th floor of a building, or I can be in Boise, Idaho, and I can have a monster house, right? And I think it caused people to
in Boise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Caused
yeah.
people to experience new things. And I think the result is red's redder, blue bluer, and I think we're just starting to experience that conflict of what that's going to create.
I also think that during COVID, and this was a big part of why I decided to move and leave, and I do thank Governor Ron DeSantis for what he did during the pandemic. I was one of those people. I mean, I was actually the one who tweeted during the pandemic early on that leaving New York City for Florida was the closest thing you could experience as an American to leaving East Germany for West Germany in the 1960s. I mean, you went from, you know, being at LaGuardia Airport where there were actual National Guard soldiers standing. Like, what are they going to shoot the virus? And the whole thing was insane. They're taking down information for test and trace, the dumbest program in the history of the universe. I remember arguing with doctors about this. I was like, guys, test and trace, this has never worked anywhere. This is insane. And they'd say, it works for STDs. Well, yeah, because when you ask, you know, you would think that's a little bit easier to figure out, right? But there was a mentality, there was a psychosis that took over the leadership class there. You came down to Florida, and people are splashing around in the ocean. They're going to restaurants. They're living their lives. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And then I realized, oh, the 90% of New York City residents who voted, or it's like 80% actually, but 90% of Manhattan is Democrat. 80% of the city is Democrat. They're part of the apparatus now. They're okay with this. Like, they've been so brainwashed that I actually reached the point where I was no longer just angry at the time, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio. I was angry at the people who were shouting at everybody to wear masks outside, because what was wrong with them? Like, what had happened to them? Fellow New Yorkers were supposed to have this, like, tough, we don't take any guff, you know, any BS from anybody attitude or whatever. No, we turned into a bunch of triple masking, you know, wimps who were begging for the government to protect them and do all this. It was crazy. And so I'm angry about what was done to the city, and I'm actually still very angry at the people who were in charge across the board.
What a point to say that. You know, New Yorkers are known to not back down, and now you're just doing whatever they're telling you to do.
Oh, that's impressive.
Adam.
Impressive research over there.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think Clay's absolutely right. Sort of during COVID, the red got redder, the blue got bluer. Born and raised in Miami, so welcome to Miami officially there.
But, awesome. Thank you.
You know, I love New York City. I'm actually going this weekend. And, I mean, I would never move there.
Yeah.
But spend a week or two there, hanging around the city, still my favorite city. I love it. Just everything that kind of comes with the city, the price attached to living in New York City, it's kind of insane. You said you get a $1 million house in Boise, you get a $1 million shoebox in New York City.
That's right.
You know, I actually went during COVID. This would have been when we were in Boca. So it would have been 2021. I do a lot of man on the street interviews, and I went around and I started interviewing everybody in New York. Basically, this was when $30 billion of tax revenue left the city.
Yeah.
And I went just talking to average people. Like, so did you stay in New York? Why'd you leave New York? What would you consider leaving New York? You know, and you get a wide variety of answers, but you know, the common themes were taxes are insane, right? The cost of living is insane. Just basically the prices are insane. And it's, one guy was like, listen, maybe just people aren't tough enough to stick it out in New York. You know, the old Frank Sinatra, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But I think, you know, I've seen so many people because I used to work in nightlife, and every basically winter, Christmas, New Year's, like the New Yorkers would come, and us South Beach promoters were like, all right, let's charge these mother suckers double. And I would see this love affair with Miami and South Florida from all the New Yorkers, and we would see them kind of tiptoe each year, like, all right, yeah, 1 week this year, 1 month, and then I'd be like, when are these guys going to freaking wake up and realize you could just move here?
Yeah.
And I think COVID basically was the impetus for them to get the hell out of here.
What you hit on, and Buck and I have talked about this, it's not just people leaving. It's the people that have the most resources that are leaving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the difference between 13 and 14% tax in California and in New York and where you guys are in Florida, where Buck is now, and where I am in Tennessee, we have no state income tax. Same thing in Texas. Let's just use those three as an example. If you make $1 million a year, that's $130,000 or $140,000 extra in your pocket. Mm. That's a million. Imagine if you make $10 million or $100 million. I don't understand. I mean, just being quite honest, I don't understand why anybody who is wealthy, and I mean supremely wealthy, would ever make their residence in New York or LA. And I think COVID, some of those guys were like, well, I've got so much money at stake. I've got a hedge fund. I got private equity. I've got to be based here. Suddenly, when COVID happened, those guys took chances in terms of where they live that they never would have otherwise, and their revenue didn't change. And then they're looking at it now, and they're like, why would I ever give a government 14% for the privilege of living somewhere?
You know, maybe that's why your Knicks suck, man. Everyone looks at the contracts going on over there. It's like, why the hell would I move to New York?
I grew up watching the Knicks, and it's funny because one of
our ongoing— Ewing, Larry Johnson, John Starks, those are your guys.
The Bomb Squad, are you kidding me? The Oak Tree, I remember all of them. My brother had an Anthony Mason jersey because his name is Mason, so it said Mason on the back. Like, we loved the Knicks growing up. I have since stopped watching both the NBA and the NFL for reasons that I don't think are—
What do you mean? You just don't watch sports anymore?
I will not watch, no.
Straight up?
For politics, yeah, I won't do it.
Because everything that happened with the Colin Kaepernick and the bubble and the social justice stuff, you're just—
Not into it. Won't do it.
Wow.
Don't watch.
And you were a lifelong sports guy?
I mean, I grew up, yeah. I grew up actually playing a little bit. I wasn't very good or anything, but I grew up playing
basketball. Maybe because you just couldn't get that helmet on your head, bro.
Well, it's funny you say that because I avoided helmet sports specifically because I didn't want, like, even this is going to give me a headache if I keep it on because my head's too big. So I stopped watching sports. I did grow up, though, going to games, Yankee Stadium. But, I mean, Yankee Stadium, just to give you showed that thing. Mm-hmm. It was like my dad would have a talk to me. Like, I remember when I was in Afghanistan, like before we would go out, in the city, and you get together with our guys, these GRS guys who are all, they're SEAL, Special Forces, Delta guys. And they're trying to, if you've seen 13 Hours, right, of course, those guys. So I was, if you see that movie, I was one of the guys that they're sort of with, they're the shooters and I'm there to, have the meeting or talk to people or whatever. But we'd have this conversation about like, well, what are we going to run up against here? Like, what do we think the chances of IEDs or whatever? It kind of reminded me when I was a little kid and my dad was like, we're going to Yankee Stadium. It was everyone in New York was like, it's really dangerous around there. Like, we're not going to go walking around there. And that was just considered, you didn't go into Central Park at night. Mm-hmm. If you went into Central Park at night growing up in New York City and you got robbed, it was on you. It was like, what are you doing in the park? This is the nicest park in the richest part of the whole city. But like, if you went in at night, you got robbed. So those are sort of the changes that I think happen psychologically in New York. But also, like, you can get... I was telling him this the other day, too. You can find what you want everywhere in the country now in a way you couldn't before. So in a lot of the big, like New York, Chicago, L.A., they had just better food than other places. I know people will argue about this, but they're wrong. Like in the 90s, a good restaurant in Nashville, no offense, was not a good restaurant in New York City. Now it is. Same level, same quality of food. You can buy anything anywhere. I made a joke on Twitter. You could go on Amazon now and buy a tank. I don't know if you still can. But it used to be you're in New York because they had the best food, the best shopping, and all the job opportunities you needed. And if you're a single guy, the biggest dating pool in the whole country concentrated in one place. A lot of that stuff now doesn't really matter.
Don't you think there's a metaphor with kind of what you're saying about these cities with exactly what we were talking about with the podcasts? And basically, you don't need to be in these mainstream legacy media companies. You can just kind of have your own YouTube channel or your own podcasting channel versus you don't need to be in these major cities anymore. You can just kind of do it from anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, building on what Buck said, I remember going to New York City as a kid. The bookstores. Like, for people out there who are around my age, I'm 44, you would go, if you grew up where I did in Goodlettsville, Tennessee, which is not necessarily the fancy area of Nashville, you went to Walden Books, right, in your mall. And Walden Books might have, I don't know, 15,000 book or titles or something in it. And you would go, if you're trying to read something, and I was a huge reader, you would go there and you would hope that they might have a book that you wanted to read, right?
Clay went to Civil War camp, by the way.
I'm a history
true
nerd,
story.
Too.
True story.
Legit Civil War sleepaway camp. But then I remember coming to New York City and being like, oh my God, Barnes & Noble. Like, my thing that I was most impressed by in New York City wasn't the, you know, huge buildings. It was all of the bookstores that were everywhere and being able to find books you couldn't get anywhere. Now, you go on Amazon, you get any book delivered to your house in 12 hours.
I mean,
right?
I moved to Miami, 6 months ago now, something like that. I haven't been shopping once. Everything just gets delivered that I need, right? And so that's true now all over the country. So it's kind of the Amazoning or Amazonification of the country has also changed, I think, one of the big advantages of being in a city. You know, for people who used to live out in like more rural areas, even some of the suburbs, it's like, oh, like, gotta, you know, if you want to get something, you had to get in a car for 40 minutes, right? Now everything gets delivered to your front door, so it changes.
And even pushing the remote concept backfired on a lot of these cities. When New York City or San Francisco, oh, everybody can work from home for the rest of their lives. Yep. Oh, really? No problem. I will work from home in Texas. I will work from home from Florida or Tennessee, and I won't pay the taxes. Not a problem. We support your remote. Now they're shitting bricks saying, no, that remote work was just a idea. We got to get back to the office. This is not working out. You know, commercial real estate's taking a hit. These Class A buildings are taking a hit. So a lot of these ideas that they drove is exactly what backfired on them.
Well, building on Buck making fun of me for reading old school newspapers, I was on the airplane yesterday reading my old school newspaper. By the way, almost the only person now on the airplane who actually carries newspapers. And to what you're saying, Facebook has fired, I think, 30% of their workforce. And I know Elon Musk has wiped out 80% of Twitter's workforce. But they said many of the top managers at Facebook now, some of the guys are living in Europe. Some of the guys, like, they aren't even top level employees at Facebook are traveling sometimes back to Silicon Valley, but they're actually based in Europe.
Yeah.
So I think to your point, the challenge that a lot of these companies are having is one, we're finding out that they can do their work with a fraction of the people, right? I mean, Twitter is running basically as effectively, it appears to me, on 1,500 employees as it was 8,000. And I think Elon Musk has given a lot of these big tech companies knowledge of just how many people they employ that that they don't need.
And just one more thing on the looking at the crime statistics. I mean, people always focus immediately on homicides for obvious reasons, right? It's the most serious crime, and also it's very hard for that to be messed with as a stat, right? People tend to know when there's a body, when someone's been killed, and that's not something that a city can hide. Quality of life stuff, though, I mean, this is what you're really seeing in San Francisco, although there's violent crime there, too, that we've seen recently. Quality of life crimes in pretty much every major city, which are all under Democrat control, not to make it too political, but it is political, they're completely through the roof, meaning just the day-to-day stuff, you know, people seeing, you know, open-air drug usage and the effective or actual decriminalization of drugs, you know, needles on the streets, all that kind of stuff. That makes people not want to go into the downtown also, right? So there's a snowball effect here. Things just kind of keep getting bigger because the remote work is easier. You can go to a low-tax place. And also, I mean, do you want to go into downtown San Francisco these days? Do you want to go into, you know, even like Times Square in New York has gotten a lot sketchier in the last few years.
You would think that, but they voted the same type of mayor in Chicago.
Yep.
San Francisco is not changing. They voted a Democratic governor, although she almost lost to the other guy who was creating a lot of momentum. What's his name? The New York governor that was running up against
Zeldin
made a name for himself. They thought, hey, you're going to run for president.
Think about this. Lee Zeldin wins. Bragg gets fired. Trump doesn't get indicted. So that decision by those Democrats in New York to go along with Lee Zeldin may change the history of the country in a pretty profound way as this legal issue for Trump plays out.
And also think about how much harder, we talked about this on the show, those cities and those states only have themselves to blame. And I think Buck's analogy on New York City is a great one, from 2,200 down to 300 or 250 or whatever the murder rate went to. It's because people in New York City got so fed up. They said, okay, bring in Rudy Giuliani. We'll elect a Republican. We're going to have to shake up what we're doing. They're so committed, the left-wingers are, that they just elected this guy Brandon Johnson in Chicago, for an example. He, and we've talked about this on the show, got the support overwhelmingly from the highest crime areas, and he's basically a defund the police guy. So one of the challenges I think that's going to be in play here is a lot of sane people have bailed, and they're just not voting there. To the point on Lee Zeldin, how many, probably several hundred thousand would-be red voters have just said, I'm done with New York. That's how we made Florida redder. It's how DeSantis won by 19 points. How much more challenging is it going to be for that pivot to occur because they're losing some of the middle-of-the-road sane voters that would otherwise have allowed moderates to win?
So let me ask you this. New York, we beat up New York plenty. Let's go to the next topic, but it's within this topic. So, you know, every election season, different topics matter. Midterms, everybody talked about Roe v. Wade, bad timing. It's McConnell's fault. He did it intentionally to hurt Trump to show that, hey, by getting an endorsement for MAGA no longer means as much as it did before. We got to go a different way. We got to get a rhino candidate, da-da-da. Okay, great. You go, Trump ran, hey, it's got to be a border. It's going to make America great again. We got to pay attention to the border, China, tariffs. You know, everybody runs on something that's timely that people are interested in. If you guys were hired to be the campaign managers or strategists behind closed doors for DeSantis or Trump, what would be the top three, you know, items you would be driving that the voters right now are most concerned about?
He wrote a book on this, so he's going to have
a lot. My book's going to be out in August.
This is the topic of his book. So I'll do an appetizer, and he can do the entree on this one. I think the border is an enormously important issue. All these things have to be messaged the right way, and people have to really understand why it matters, as well as just the constant, you know, bringing this up and part of the national conversation. I mean, I think the border, the economy is always top three. So what could be done for the economy that would be better than what we've seen? And I really also think as Ukraine is heating up, people that come forward and explain how we spent 20 years fighting in wars. I was, as a civilian CIA analyst, not a door kicker, but I was in a couple of those war zones, saw what was going on personally. The fact that it feels like we've almost forgotten the lessons of what are we doing here and what is the strategy this quickly with this Ukraine mission creep. It is 100% mission creep that we have. You know, it's always incremental. So it feels like, oh, but we're not, you know, we don't have you. Well, actually, we do have U.S. troops there, as they've now come out and said.
What do you mean by mission creep? That it's just going to incrementally get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger of a thing?
Exactly.
So it's not like we're going to be pulling out anytime soon, like an Afghanistan situation. We're going to be doubling down. Is that
we are going to be supporting the Ukrainians against the Russians for years. This war will go on for years. And anybody who doubts that should remember that the war has been going on already since 2014 when they initially invaded the Donbass and then had the phony referendum in Crimea. I mean, it was a referendum, but it was at gunpoint, whatever. This has already been building for a long time. This issue is much more important to the Russians than it is to us. They will go to the mat on this one. There is no, oh, Putin's under too much pressure. The guy who takes over after Putin, he's not going to want to give up Ukraine either, whoever that would be. So somebody who can say, I'm going to keep us out of a war. We're only going to war if someone's starting a war with us. I think that would be very powerful. And I think that's why Trump, by the way, in his recent Tucker interview, focused so much on that foreign policy piece. Secure the border. And then I know you said three. I'm sorry. Economy, we could all agree. And the other one would be crime. Crime is huge. Republicans are up 10, up 12, up 15, depending on the poll you see, against Democrats in crime because they basically decided to legalize crime as part of a social justice initiatives and all kinds of crazy left-wing abolish the police ideology. So that's what we got.
So you mentioned DeSantis and Trump. Let me actually start with Biden. If Trump is the nominee, Joe Biden, my concern is, and I think it's true, Joe Biden's entire record won't matter because his entire campaign is going to be, I'm not Trump. And most of the time, elections are referendums on the incumbent. My concern is Trump versus Biden 24, the entire story is going to be Biden saying, I'm not Trump, and those suburban, college-educated white women who overwhelmingly abandoned Trump, I don't know how Trump gets them back. So if I were advising Trump, I would say your entire campaign has to be moms. Because how do you change? What has occurred in the last 4 years? If I'm advising Trump, you need to be running a general election campaign starting now. And you have to appeal. How do you get those people back? That is the sole focus, because Buck and I have talked about this on the show. We certainly talk about it off air. It's the number one conversation. Let's presume 81 million people. Let's take the numbers that are out there. 81 million roughly voted for Biden. Obviously, rig job, benefit of COVID, changing the rules, all those things. I don't want to have the debate, but 81 million, 75 million roughly for Trump, 156 million voters. How many of those people are willing to change their mind in 2024 if we have a rematch?
How many do you think, actually?
A million, right? I don't think that. I think people are, this goes to the point on you're voting Democrats, red, redder, blue, bluer. I think people are so dug in. It's like trench warfare in politics. It's hard to get the lines to move at this point. So what do you have to do if you are Trump? To me, you have to convince all those women. And this is why the abortion thing, I think, is going to play in, because I think they'll just terrify you. You know, your daughter, she gets pregnant, she's 14. She's not, Trump's going to keep her from getting an abortion, right? Like that's the, they're going to go after the suburban college moms, and it's going to be a challenge.
So I have a slightly different pathway for Trump if he is in fact the nominee on the Republican side, just because I think what Clay is saying about the numbers is obviously true. I think Trump's ability to win back those voters is close to zero. So the only,
you don't think he can flip the, you're saying the
soccer
like
moms?
Yeah.
No chance.
They're checked out.
No chance. No chance. And I love Trump. I mean, I think he's a great guy. I mean, when I say that, I actually mean that on a more like personal level. I think he's a great guy. Really, you know, Clay and I have spent a lot of time with him. I've actually known him and the family since I was a little kid in New York too. Not well, but you know, I met him at different events and things.
He went to prom with Ivanka.
Brag, you can't on yourself. Do that. It was junior prom.
Real
it
story?
Was junior prom. It was like she was a friend. I can't believe he just blew me off.
You know, it's kind of, I would brag. Can't buddy, you just
no.
Buddy,
that's the most interesting thing you've like said so far. What are you talking about?
So
you got to give a shit about Afghanistan?
All these opinions like CIA.
Yeah, and exactly.
You'd have been like, he went to prom with Ivanka.
Looking at you in a whole different way.
So
here, I thought you were this big-headed dude that just you know talks politics. Now I know you got some game.
Yeah, it was no. There's no photo of it online. It was junior prom.
All right, it's prom.
Junior prom. Junior.
You went with Ivanka. Let's relax. Really, Buck, you're doing your thing.
So. Yeah, I mean, Jared's a very powerful man.
By the way, they're down here in Miami.
If Jared is worried about who his girlfriend, who his wife dated when
15,
she was 16. By the way, have you guys gone to your wives or girlfriends like high school reunions or college reunions? Have you guys been to any of those events?
No.
Oh. Well,
so
but this is an experience.
To see who they dated, you're saying?
Yes, that's
I mean, important. I did have the LA Times reached out to me. I saw the DM somewhere on Facebook, and they were just like, we've seen the photos of you and Ivanka at the Regis prom. Like, would you like to comment? I didn't even respond. I was like, what am I going to comment? Like, we were 15-year-old kids. Like, there's like priests everywhere. I went to a Jesuit school. Like, I don't even understand what we're talking about.
I would have been like, but yes, but not on the record.
It was funny, though, because she's a total sweetheart and a really, really nice, always has been a really nice person. I didn't realize how much at the time. It actually was the other girls who were there, who all, because she was really big in the, like, 16 magazine or, you know, whatever, you know, teen magazine. Those kind of, like, fashion magazines for younger people.
Tiger Beat, back in the day, man.
So she was taking photos with them for, like, I was just, like, there by myself talking to Guz, like, yeah, you know, she's my friend. She came, you know, she was not my girlfriend. I don't want to, like, overplay this, but anyway, she's a cool lady. So I've known the Trumps for a long time. Back to political analysis. But I think Trump's a great guy. I don't think he can win back those suburban moms. I think the way that he wins is white working class voters who, for example, voted for Obama twice and then flipped in 2016 in the key states. I think that's it.
You just got to win back the Rust Belt again.
100%.
He's got to get
union guys with high school degrees from Wisconsin, Michigan to believe again and to show up for him. He does that. I think he can flip enough votes to do it. If he can do the suburban soccer mom thing, I mean, then he's definitely going to win.
What about DeSantis?
If I were advising DeSantis, so let's go back. This is the primary advice. I think DeSantis has to go balls to the wall. And I think he has to, you know, they just announced that Fox News is going to have the first debate in August in Milwaukee. I think it's going to be on Rumble as well.
This August.
This August. It'll be the first debate. I think that DeSantis has to say on the stage, you lost to Joe Biden. You got your ass kicked by the worst president that any of us have ever lived through. He's a joke. You lost to him. Call out Trump directly Andy has to say, and if you're the nominee, you will lose to him again. And DeSantis has to say, not only will I not lose to him, I will kick his ass. So if you want a president who is a Republican, by the way, you could have me for 8 years instead of four with Trump. I think he has to go ball. You can't tiptoe up to it. Wow. Because, and here's my thesis on that. If he says that to Trump, I think Trump, being called a loser, will be so furious about the fact that he gets called a loser that Trump will go back into his, they stole the election, this is why I lost. And I think that doesn't have the same resonance. And I think a lot of people want to win so badly. DeSantis's play is, I'm an electable version of Trump. I will be a more disciplined version of him. You saw the way that I responded to COVID. I didn't, you know, defer to Dr. Anthony Fauci and everybody else as long as Trump did. I think he has to go right after him. Because here's what I'll say. Trump is way better in individual. Like if you had Trump and DeSantis in this room right now, or just to meet all your staff out there, I think people would be like, holy cow, Trump is amazing on the just grip and grin, the shake, the individual interaction. I don't think DeSantis has that same charisma.
Yeah, why would he? Trump's been an icon for 40 years, 50 years.
He spent his whole life exactly. Shaking hands and chatting with
his
people.
His daughter went to a prom with our friend Buck over here. That's a big deal.
So I think, you know, the Iowa and New Hampshire thing that will surprise people is Trump's really good going into McDonald's and like shaking hands and kissing babies. I'm not sure DeSantis is going to be, but that's a risky proposition for DeSantis, by the way, because if you go all in after Trump in 24 and he loses, how does that impact things in 28? Will people remember that and
for
be
DeSantis?
Angry? Yeah.
Can you even think that? You got to go 6 years in the future?
But I think sometimes people don't
go. You kind of got to go with what's right in front of your face now.
They don't go balls to the wall because they're worried about the future. If he wants to win, he has to like basically burn the ships behind him and say, this is it.
So I think that it depends on the Trump approach to dealing with DeSantis once he gets in, which I think is likely to be, based on what we've seen so far, just total scorched earth. Although, I do know some people who are in Trump world who are saying they're a little surprised that some of the... they're so used to Trump insults just crushing people, right? Like Little Marco and Low Energy Jeb and, you know, go down the list, right?
Crooked Hillary.
Yeah, probably the best. Yeah. I mean, that one line might have won him the 2016 election. He's so good at that. But even ardent Trump supporters and voters, when he says Florida's always been great, Ron DeSantis didn't do a good job, they go, ooh, wait, no. Like, that's not a thing, you know? There are other things maybe you could say or criticize or go after him on, but saying that Ron wasn't good during COVID, some of that starts to feel like he's insulting the intelligence of the people who support him the most, and people like me who voted for him twice. You got to say things, you know, they're going to hit each other, right? But it's got to be a clean fight in the sense that, you know, I know it's going to be tough, but it's got to be a clean fight in the sense that it has to be based in some form of
reality. So you guys are part of the camp that you believe Trump doesn't beat Biden, but you believe DeSantis could beat Biden directly.
That's not, I think Trump, to go back to your point, if I were advising Trump, I would say start running the general election now. Because I think he minimizes himself when he goes after DeSantis. What I had hoped Trump was going to say in Mar-a-Lago right after he got indicted, and had to appear for the arraignment, I wish he had said, it's time for all Republicans to come together. I won't say a single negative word about Ron DeSantis. I'm focused on Biden. He's the enemy.
Yeah, he elevates himself and he wins. That's the way I see it.
You know there's no chance he's going down that
No,
road.
But he should.
You know that.
I think that's
he should.
That's the way that's true. He could win. My concern is, you guys watch Game of Thrones? Back in the day?
Yeah, like 10 years ago.
You didn't watch Game of Thrones?
No.
Oh, my God.
He's watched one show, House of Cards. That was it, right?
That's it.
Wow.
Game of Thrones. So Game of Thrones, we've talked about this on the show. You have trial by combat. The benefit that Republicans have right now is you know who your combatant is. In theory, it's Joe Biden. He's a shitty fighter. He should get his ass kicked. My concern is if Democrats can pick their opponent, they're trying to put Trump in the ring against Biden because they think they can beat Trump. And so Trump has to be more sophisticated than he was in 16 and 20 to win. And I feel like so many people, to Buck's point, have a preconceived conclusion of Trump. I think DeSantis would smoke Joe Biden.